Hello everybody and welcome to today's Radio Edu Talk. I'm absolutely delighted to welcome to the show Colin Webster, who's Development Officer for the Ellen MacArthur Foundation in Scotland. Welcome to the show, Colin.
Hi there, David. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, it's great to have you along. And tonight we're going to be talking about the work of the foundation and also going to be hearing about the whole notion of a circular economy. This is a pre-recorded show. And going out as usual at 8 p.m. on a Wednesday evening. Therefore, there won't be any opportunity for live interaction. But if you have a comment or a question for Colin after listening to this broadcast or the archive recording, then you can get in touch in two ways. Primarily, you can email the show at edutalker, edutalkr, at hotmail.co.uk. Or if you're on Twitter, just pop something up and include the hashtag EduTalk. Colin, just to start off with tonight, would you mind just giving us a little bit of a flavour of your career and I suppose right up to the present day?
Yeah, sure. I was a late comer to university, so I'd dossed around in all sorts of different jobs and offices and in retail and so on. I went into university because I really fancied being a teacher, a primary teacher initially. But I ended up doing a degree in geography and economic and social history, which ultimately led to a secondary school, PGDE, at Murray House, in geography. So I did my probationary year in East Lothian, worked there for a year, and then couldn't find another job in teaching. I was fairly inflexible about where I would move. And I got a job working for National Youth Work Agency, Youth Scotland. Worked for them in a curriculum for excellence development role for around about a year and a half, and then this job for the Ellen MacArthur Foundation came up, and it seemed to combine a lot of what I'd done before, and I found it very exciting what the Ellen MacArthur Foundation was trying to do, and was delighted when they offered me this post, and I've been in this post now for a year, just over a year, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that. I would imagine many listeners will only just be coming kind of aware of the work of the foundation and about the kind of notions of a circular economy. We may have come across you at various events around Scottish education, but I suppose it's probably most appropriate just to start off with just an introduction from yourself as to the work of the foundation and a kind of basic definition of what a circular economy is and what it might look like.
Yeah, sure. Or do you want me to start off talking a little bit about Ellen and why she's involved?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll just say that there's a fantastic introductory video, the link that you provided before tonight's show, and that will be up on the website just underneath the audio. If anybody wants to click on that link or any others from tonight's show.
Okay, grand. Well, the Ellen MacArthur in question, of course, is the lady who sailed around the world in about 2004 and was in all the newspapers and so on as a result. And she's a very good public speaker. And if you ever see her speak publicly, she tends to talk about her personal story, which is, she had this vision, this dream of sailing around the world, and she really set her heart on this particular goal. And it struck her then when she was on this journey more so than ever before that the stuff she had in her boat with her was all she had. And should she run out of stuff, then she was lucky enough she could pull over at some port and she could restock, although that wouldn't be much good in a race around the world. But nevertheless, she could. And she used that, I suppose, as a metaphor for how we treat the planet and what are we going to do if we run out of resources. So once she got back, she decided that she was going to retire from professional sailing and decided to go on a bit of an exploratory tour to ask questions about resources and about the future and about what we were thinking and how things could be. And she was promoting, I suppose, a sustainability message, she says, the sort of reduce the harm message, use a bit less resources, that sort of thing. She found that a lot of doors would be closed on her, and she was a bit dissatisfied with the message, actually. Especially when she came across a few people who were thinking a bit differently. People were promoting a different type of economy, a philosophy which was positive and possible, a circular philosophy about how we can use stuff without using it up. And that really got her thinking that this was something actually that she could really invest her energy into. And that's exactly what she's done. About 2.5 years ago, she set up the foundation to promote this idea of a regenerative, restorative, circular economy, and to really change people's minds in terms of how we produce, how we consume, and the skills that we'd need to help get us to that sort of regenerative future. So I think always the best way to describe what the circular economy is to start with where we are just now and describe how a circular economy is different. So if you look back down the last 150 years or whatever, it'd be fair to say we produce stuff in a very linear fashion, which is we take raw materials out of the ground, we turn them into products, and ultimately we throw them away. So it's a linear system because the flow of materials and of energy goes in one direction. It's a throughput system, if you like, and it ends up with a lot of waste in the ground and, of course, a lot of waste in the air too. But nevertheless, the waste that's created in the system isn't simply the waste that happens at the end of the system. It's the waste is generated throughout because it's a fairly sloppy system, I think it's fair to say. Most waste is created at the early stages of the extraction of materials and the production from virgin materials, and most energy is used there too. So that's how we've produced things for a long time, and it's been a very successful system for some people more so than others, but I think it's fair to say that general standards of living and material wealth have risen around the world, some parts of course not, but in a lot of places it has done. So you might ask yourself, you know, why would we challenge such a concept? Well, we challenge it because actually we're seeing signs of decline for this linear system. This linear system depends on high volume of purchases to match the high volume of production. And of course, there'd only be high volume of purchases if there's a high volume of income. And since the 1970s, actually, levels of income have been falling as productivity's increased. And, of course, we're in the midst of a credit crisis at the moment where banks just aren't lending as much money as they did before. Shops are closing down as a result. Businesses are closing down. People are going out of work. So they don't have the cash to keep oiling the wheels of this linear system. And the linear system also depends on materials being cheap and energy being cheap. Because if you think about it, you know, why would someone like Apple, to pick on an obvious example, why would they produce a different phone every few years, knowing fine well people are going to throw them away? Unless they wouldn't do that unless they knew that their materials were cheaper the next year and the energy would be cheaper to produce their stuff. But actually, we're no longer in an era of cheap energy and of cheap materials. And there's a lot of firms out there, I think, are in denial of that and are still producing stuff in this design for obsolescence, cradle to grave manner. So material prices have risen in 10 years, in fact. In the last 10 years, they've risen to such an extent they've wiped out a century's decline. And that's a huge problem for all sorts of businesses. Your average EU car manufacturer last year spent 500 million euros more in raw materials than they did the year prior to that. 500 million, that's a huge sum of money. And we know in one manufacturer's case, that was half of their operating profit that was wiped out by that material rise alone. And of course, hand in hand with that is an energy price rise. And I think we all know about the problem with energy prices just from our own bills. So, and then if you look around at solutions that people propose for this linear system and the problems that it faces, actually most solutions tend to be based on kind of do the same but a little bit better. And economically, there aren't many solutions out there. You know, let's get the banks lending again. But ultimately, I'm not sure where that's going to lead us to. Environmentally, a lot of the solutions are based on slightly modifying a linear system. So we say we'll use a bit less stuff, but actually if we use a bit less stuff, it doesn't really add up because the stuff we're talking about is finite stuff. So using it, a bit less of it just delays inevitable. Or we can recycle a bit more, and yeah, okay, we could recycle a bit more, but actually most stuff can't be recycled because of the way it's been built. And even if it could be recycled, recycled's a fairly inefficient process. So we need to come up with something a bit better. And so people use terms like green the economy or make it more sustainable or make it more eco-friendly. And I think a lot of those messages are a little bit mixed because many of the ideas that are within those terms are based on the concept of reducing the harm that we're causing rather than having a real goal about creating something more regenerative, more restorative. And there's a lot of determined individuals out there who do want to change the system or want to change their own lifestyles, but they're battling against a broken system in which they can only make a very small impact. And amidst all the back of that, of course, there aren't many economics, much economics being discussed. So how do we get the economy going again? Because we see everything really is an interconnected series of problems. So you've got all sorts of issues to do with, say, drinking water and health and employment and the materials crisis, the energy crisis, emissions and toxicity, and then the fall in credit. They're all connected problems, and we have to deal with them in a connected manner. Any questions so far, David? Don't interrupt.
Well, I mean, it's very, very deep. It's an interesting solution that seems to be kind of forming, and this idea of a circular economy. And I just wonder how you get the idea of what needs to change, or what might happen in the future, or what I understand might be happening in places like China and Holland already. You know, when you're explaining to young people, is it the best kind of practical examples, or the kind of wishful thinking, is it along the lines of the idea of, for example, the fridge, about the fridge going, this was the one I was looking at today, the fridge becoming obsolete or whatever, or redundant, or end of its life, and then going back and being turned into the latest model? I mean, is that the best way to kind of get across what you're, or one aspect of the circular economy?
I think I think for the benefit of those who haven't come across us before, or the idea of the circular economy, just to quickly explain, you're talking about the fridge idea. And basically, it's about looking at materials and looking at energy in a slightly different way. We're getting our inspiration from nature and saying, well, nature works in all sorts of cycles, and together it forms a system. And within natural systems, there's no such thing as waste, because one species waste becomes another species food. And we want to use that as an example of how actually our economy could work, our industrial economy could work. So what we need is designers really to be sitting down when they're designing a product to ask themselves this question: how can this product be made to be made again? How can we get it back, the materials back at high quality, so we can repurpose them, reuse them? We need to be designing for repair, designing for remanufacture, designing for disassembly, so that we can completely disassemble products at the end of their life and use all of those component pieces again to make the materials work for us. So material productivity is what we're interested in, rather than, say, material efficiency, which is a big buzz phrase at the moment. But also energy productivity, because, you know, when you remanufacture a product, you don't have to use as much energy as you did with that original extraction and production from virgin raw materials. So if I give you an example off that, Renault, the car manufacturer, they've got a network of 220 garages. They're supplying them with old Renault parts. They're shipping them to a place in France, and there they're refurbishing them, they're remanufacturing these parts, and they're selling them with an as-new warranty for half the cost of a new part. Yet at the same time, Renault are making a third more profit than they do compared to new parts. And they're able to do that, make that profit at that price cost for the customer, because their energy costs are significantly reduced, 75% less. And of course, hand-in-hand with that is CO2 emissions being reduced too. And their material costs are reduced as well. And what they're moving towards now is a more joined-up approach, a real system of production, so that their cars are easier to disassemble at the end of their life, their parts are easier to remanufacture. And, of course, that would just mean for them more profit. And as we've seen with that one example, they're passing that profit on to customers too, are getting cheaper stuff as a result. Mm-hmm. So it's about that design for regeneration. And it's also about a performance economy, asking questions. I mean, you said about a fridge there. And I suppose the question with a fridge is, what do we really want? Do we really want to own a fridge, or do we want cold food? Mm-hmm. Of course, it's the cold food we want. We want the service that our stuff gives us, and rather than the ownership of the thing. Because, you know, fridges and washing machines and carpets, actually, they're all problematic, aren't they? When they reach the end of their life, we as individuals have got to deal with what we do with them. And of course, in all those three examples, we take them to the dump. And perhaps a lot of us assume that something nice happens to them when they go there, but they don't. They all end up in landfill. But if we were renting these products from manufacturers, we're renting them for their performance. And the manufacturers would have a vested interest in making sure that they can be easily repaired and upgraded. And in the case of the washing machine, you know, most advancements have been in the software. So you could simply make a system there where you could upgrade the software when you need to make the machine more efficient in terms of the energy it uses, the water it uses, and the cleaning that it does. And in the examples we've seen, actually the customer becomes a winner in that example from leasing the machine, because they get a better washing machine at a lower per wash cost. And that challenges a lot of perceptions from folk like me who are a little bit older, who remember hiring televisions being an expensive thing and an old-fashioned idea. But actually, you know, if we want the latest technology, then perhaps you do have to rent it. If you look at mobile phones today, most people keep them for like a year or two, and then they want the next one, the better one. And I think from a young person's perspective, you ask a class of young people, do you want to have the same phone in 5 years' time? Very few of them would say yes to that. Now, what if we were renting them? What if they were being disassembled when they went back to the manufacturers and all those component pieces were used again to make the next phone? Then actually, you're creating a lot of jobs along the way too, mm-hmm. as well as enabling people to have that latest technology.
Mm-hmm. So tell us then a bit about the work that you're doing with teachers, with people in other areas of education, and with young people themselves.
Well, the majority of my work in this year has been with teachers. I've been going around Scotland meeting with secondary school teachers. It is secondary that we're most interested in. Introducing them to the idea of the circular economy. And to most teachers, of course, it's new because we're only 2.5 years old. And we didn't invent the idea of the circular economy, but you know, we've certainly promoted it greatly. So most teachers are new to this concept, and a lot of them do find it challenging because I don't know if you agree, but there's a lot of concepts I've talked about there that are really quite different from how we do things right now. So there's a fair bit of head scratching that goes on when I introduce the idea, and I want to find out from teachers really where they can integrate learning about the circular economy into their lessons and into the curriculum. I suppose you get mixed results from that. Mm-hmm. What we're finding, I mean, obviously it's a time of massive upheaval in Scottish education with the new qualifications and CFE, and we find actually most teachers would say to me quite quickly that they can see this being an interdisciplinary project for the broad general education, and they'll talk about doing things in S2 and business studies, they'll do a bit of this, and science will do a bit of that. And that's fascinating, and that would be lovely to hear how those types of projects develop. But what we're really interested in is the senior phase, because we're talking about some high-level concepts, we're talking about employment, and it's a great fit, really, for a lot of qualifications out there. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what you're saying about the work that you've done, you've done with teachers, is there also a way into actually changing the way that schools operate themselves? So whether it's, I suppose what I'm getting at, have you had kind of contact or discussions with, for example, head teachers or heads of service about how schools and local authority education departments might go about exemplifying the principles of the circular economy and what they do day to day?
Well, we work very closely with one high school in particular, that's Paisley Grammar, mm-hmm. who have become what we call a Pathfinder school, and we've got four of those in England as well. And the idea there is they would teach it across the curriculum, and we'd see the results of that from both the young people and the employees. And we'd use that as a model of how things could be done. And so they're doing some interesting things at Paisley. And we speak with, I most often speak with teachers rather than heads or heads of education, but there was one local authority I went to recently, spoke with the heads of education and the whole education team, and they loved the idea of the circular economy. They want to adopt it as a local authority. But of course, it comes down to ultimately the classroom teachers and getting the message to them and how that pans out. And that hasn't quite come off yet. We've made some attempts to speak with a whole bunch of teachers in that particular authority, but isn't working the way that we would have hoped just yet. But hopefully things can take off still. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think because we're at a time of transition, I think that's what people keep scratching their heads with. How do we integrate this?
I would imagine that some teachers would maybe say, well, you know, let's do a piece of work around this and we'll link it into other developments, other more kind of established aspects of the curriculum, or maybe not, maybe that's just an assumption on my part, but you know, have you come across, or have you even been involved in it as an organisation with other developments such as Eco Schools? Or of course there's an assumption there that anything that can be perceived as green will be of the same ilk, and you know, maybe your approach is kind of differs from other kind of green conservation sustainability developments in schools.
Yeah, I agree with you. That is how we see ourselves. That I think there's a lot of great work that's been done by a lot of sustainability groups in starting to challenge people's thinking. But they're promoting ideas ultimately that we're not really that interested in some cases. I mean, we're not interested in reduce, reuse, recycle. We think that's the wrong message for the long term. And also, we're talking about systems change rather than behaviour change. And a lot of the sustainability groups concentrate on challenging the individual and the choices that they make. And that's important that that's going on, but it doesn't really fit within our entire philosophy. It complements it, if you like. So I don't see a great correlation between working with those types of groups. We have been working with the likes of CERC, the science people, hoping to develop stronger ties with them in terms of developing resources for science teachers, obviously, in that case. And I should say, we do have a whole bunch of teaching resources. We've got about 700 of them. They're all free on our website and videos and so on that people can go off and download and use. But we want to make them as simple as possible for people to pick up and use in their classes. And I want I want the chemistry teacher from Murray to be able to pick up something and say, this fits perfectly into National 5 or, you know, whatever, along those lines. Mm-hmm. But we can only do that, obviously, by working closely with teachers so that they can give us the feedback and the value of our resources.
And what kind of guidance are you, or advice are you providing teachers with? I mean, when you start talking about things like systems thinking and systems change, that makes me think more of the senior phase, but also that potentially it could go, you know, right across the new curriculum.
Yeah, it could absolutely go right across, and I think the reason why schools are grasping at an idea of an interdisciplinary project in the broad general then is simply because I guess it's easier to play with classes in such a way at those stages.
Just going back to my understanding of the circular economy from my limited reading, but you know, there are kind of criticisms or some kind of issues seem to repeat themselves in what some people are saying across social media and blog comments and such like. And one of the ones that jumped out for me is that some people are stating that they, in their opinion, should we go down this route, that there would be a risk of increased unemployment, that there would be a reduction in the amount of kind of positive work that would be there, because it seems to predicate itself on ultimately a reduction in consumption or wasteful consumption.
Well, actually, we produced two economic reports. Actually, it was McKinsey & Co., who are one of the biggest names in global management consultancy. Yeah. We went to and asked them to produce two reports into the circular economy and its benefits and its potential. And actually, they were quite sceptical at first, but then after a bit of research for a few months, they were astonished at what they were finding. And ultimately, they've come back with two reports which say that the global savings are $2 trillion per annum. Mm-hmm. And that's astonishing numbers. But what they're saying at the same time is that employment rises. If we look at that example Renault gave you, they're employing people in France, a high labour cost country relative to the rest of the world, to remanufacture their these old parts. Yet they're still making a profit from it. And I could also talk about Ricoh, who remanufacture printers. They make printers, and I don't know where they make them, but they remanufacture them in Coventry. They employ 400 people to do that. Mm-hmm. And if we started a service economy that's based on leasing stuff rather than ownership, then actually you're creating a lot of work along the way. You've got the people involved in the leasing and the financing, the customer service. You've got the people who are repairing and who are remanufacturing. And then you've got all the collection services that are in between. In fact, our linear economy is actually employment light, and in comparison to what a circular economy could be. So it's all there, all the details in our economic report. And anyone who's making the employment argument, I'd encourage them to read it.
Another
the other criticism, David?
Another one that it was very quickly countered. Was it, again, people were talking about, well, if it's a multinational company and if something, say for example a car's been manufactured or parts have been manufactured across a wide geographical area, that when it comes to breaking it down again, that's going to be using a lot of fuel costs and such like to get all the constituent parts back to where they originated. I know it's very, very simplistic, but then other people were saying that, many of us are aware, people have engaged with education technology in recent years, the idea of a kind of open source movement. But people were talking about open source technology within communities, therefore, as products were broken back down again, because everybody had access to the knowledge and the knowledge about the technologies required, that everything would be localised. So breaking parts down, breaking products back down again, through to being able to repair and maintain branded products, because if the whole approach is open source, then everybody in localities would be able to engage with the products and engage with the services. Is that an argument that you've come across, Colin?
I've not come across that before. Yeah. No. The point about the manufacturing from all sorts of different locations, I don't really understand that. I mean, because we are talking about remanufacturing them. In fact, the estimation is that they'll be remanufactured on a regional basis.
Right. So
a remanufacturing plant in France and one somewhere in Africa and one in Latin America or whatever. We're not talking about sending stuff back to where it came from.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about remanufacturing in different plants across the world.
Okay.
In terms of the open source movement, I think... Sir Ken Robinson, when he gives his speeches about education, talks about a revolution happening and no one's asking for permission. And I think the open source movement has been part of that. There is a real revolution in terms of these things. And I wish I could still be using Ubuntu in my desktop computer, but it doesn't like PowerPoint, sadly. I really need to use that. So I'm a big fan of open source software and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And check out an idea like 3D printing. It's a real open source idea, I would argue. And 3D printing, I think, has got a central role to play in a circular economy in terms of us being able to endlessly customize the products that we have and play around with them in such ways. And we work closely with the Mac Lab in Glasgow. It's an open source design lab, and they open their doors to whoever wants to go in and be a designer. And that's exactly the philosophy that we promote and where we're coming from. We want to work with people who are doing such things and work with those emerging innovators who are coming up with great ideas.
Mm-hmm. We're just coming into the last couple of minutes of tonight's show, and it's been absolutely fascinating. Colin, I mean, you say that's made it clear right from the start, you know, it is early days, that you're getting a lot of engagement in schools with teachers. So, just give us an idea about where things are going to go now, and if you could maybe let us know a bit more information about, for example, how to access the lesson resources that you spoke about earlier.
Yeah, sure. Where are things going? Well, actually, we're about to launch our first MOOC, our massively open online course. And if anyone's interested in that, you can find out about that on our website. And, that goes back to that Ken Robinson quote about the revolution being underway. And MOOCs seem to be something that could be part of that future. And this whole idea of flipped learning as well. I know there's people in our education department at the foundation are very excited about the potential that's there.
What would your understanding then be of how might you engage with the notion of flipped learning for professionals or for students? What kind of thinking have you undergone so far?
Well, we are big fans of using social media, of making videos to explain the concepts and making learning tools open and accessible for whoever wants to use them. So we want to examine the scene to see what teachers would find useful, what young people would find useful in such a way. How can we help teach classes for teachers, I guess, in this sort of massive way that flipped learning and MOOCs offers?
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Uh-huh. And in terms of the lesson resources, and how would people get access to those?
The lesson resources are free to download from our website. Just go to ellenmacarthurfoundation.org and all of our stuff's there. And as I said, I'm really keen to engage with secondary teachers, and if they are keen to get involved with me, then I'm sure you'll have my details on your website, David.
Yeah.
We run stuff. We run labs called Teardown Labs that have been very popular, very successful. I've been running them mostly with teachers, but a combination actually of teachers and architects and designers all coming together in that interdisciplinary way, taking products apart and looking at how they've been made, and then having a real debate about how things could be. Mm-hmm. And I'm just starting to run those with schools as well. So actually Queen Anne High School, I think it's called, in Dunfermline.
Yes. Uh-huh.
I'll be going there soon, and there's a school in Ayrshire as well that I'll be going to soon to run such lessons with their classes. Mm-hmm. And I want to do more of that sort of thing. It's exciting stuff. I love working with young people. And mm-hmm. I love seeing the reaction that young people give actually to this idea of the circular economy. They find it, generally speaking, very positive, inspiring in some cases, because we're not telling them that they've got to change their lifestyle in mm-hmm. order to adapt the circumstances around us. We're saying actually we can redesign things if we're clever enough about it, if we think deeply enough about how things could be, and if we challenge a lot of concepts that are out there. And that seems to resonate well with young people, and so that's exciting to see that happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Colin, it's been a real pleasure to have you on the show tonight. Thank you so much for giving up your valuable time. You've been listening to Colin Webster of the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, and we've been talking around notions of a circular economy. So thanks very much, Colin, and we'll gather all the various links and contact details, yep. maybe your Twitter handle and such like, and sure. We'll put them all up in the website. And you know, I've certainly really enjoyed getting an insight into this area that was, despite reading some stuff online in recent months, it's certainly my understanding of it is growing greatly over the last half an hour or so. So thank you so much, and genuinely best wishes for the future.
Thanks very much, David. Thanks for having me on.
Okay.